This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Salalia Dean. You're listening to the New Books Network Library Science Channel. I am here with Simone Gigliotti. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, that's fine.
The author of Restless Archive, The Holocaust and the Cinema of the Displaced. Would you mind introducing yourself and your book? And I think especially in your case, the format of your book, which is digital forward.
Yeah, thank you so much, Halel. My name is Simone Gigliotti, and I'm a reader in Holocaust studies, which is like an almost professor in the history department at Royal Holloway University of London in the United Kingdom. And the book, or the project Restless Archive, looks at how films and archival fragments about refugees and displaced persons have really formed the background of Holocaust cinema, but have not really been studied in their own right, and they're kind of a shadow cinema. And so my goal in this project, which is a kind of multi-dimensional expression as a multi-layered book, digital exhibition, and a kind of repatriation of these archives into a kind of two platforms mainly, and to showcase these practices of image making, and how refugees and Jewish displaced persons were depicted. And I do that through providing, the book as you see it online, as you would scholars conceptualize a book. And then the challenge was really about how we kind of express that in a digital format, and then looking at the limitations and potential of that format and how else I could augment that with other platforms to really realize the argument of kind of history as practices of spatiality and movement and embedding the archive into the locations of history, so to speak.
So what are some of the other technologies that are integrated into the book?
Okay, so the book, well, Manifold is a kind of open source, it's not open source, we wish it was, but it's not. It's a kind of digital publishing platform, and it's really pioneered in the United States through a kind of scholarly collaboration and with creative tech collaboration. And lots of publishers have their book catalogs on there, things that have been published in print and kind of migrated. So that's one of the platforms. And then I've used Story Maps, which I've worked with quite a while. And this is an Esri kind of geospatial storytelling platform. And I've used that to kind of help me create maps, digital maps from archival sources. And then I've also learned things like Vimeo, Adobe Creative Cloud, making websites, film trailers, just to think through some of the concepts, but also to engage the reader in a way that is very visual and speaks to the, limited attention span of some. I want to kind of bring them in a way. So I wanted to communicate visually and to kind of put the readers in the moment, so to speak.
And to anyone who's listening, this everything is open access, and I will link it in the episode notes. So as we're discussing, you can actually just click through, which is not true of any interview I've done so far. So there's a lot of material and to read and to sort of consume in other ways. So let's talk about this archive that you are studying. As you put it in the book, the archive is fragmented and locationally dispersed. So how did you conceptualize it? What exactly are you investigating? And what were the limits of the archive as you imagined it?
So the fragmented and locationally dispersed, so working with film archives and film books Some scholars might look at, a chapter per book, for example, to form the kind of narrative content. But as a historian and also someone who works in interdisciplinary studies, I'm interested in image making and image dissemination and what is the archive in this sense. And I think with Holocaust cinema, we have a very fused and blended, if not distorted, kind of archive. Lots of images blend and bleed into each other. So I was not kind of aware of, in some of them, where their kind of origins are. And I was interested in non-fiction, which is, again, a loose term when we think about image making. But I was interested in where do today's image archives reside, not feature cinema, but also documentary cinema, home movies, the 1930s, 1920s, Eastern interwar Europe period, the YIVO archives. There's so much, there's JDC, Yad Vashem, YIVO, as I mentioned, USHMM, national institutions, but less so and less kind of known about or discussed are the private home movie archives. So my goal here was really to open up for the reader and the viewer some of these archival materials, but uniting all of them was the focus on displacement in the 1930s and the 1940s and how we can really bring these archives together in the platforms, curate them, and provide a kind of almost like a kind of a guide or roadmap through the amazingly dispersed archive, and what this kind of reveal about the political sentiments, the prejudices, and also the ambitions of Jewish refugees and displaced persons who want to transcend those categories and, seek a home, seek a place, and how they're obstructed in doing so. And that's a very politically, politically tense period, to say the least, but there's also an immense creative process that is actually speaks to this displacement.
I think it's really interesting that you just called the archive a roadmap, given the content of the book. A lot of ways to conceptualize and understand historical movement that we will get into shortly. I want to talk a little bit more about the subjects. You just said you're interested in these people who were displaced, they were migrating, they were seeking home. And that is a core concept in Restless Archive, this concept of the home seeker. Where did you draw this idea from, and how does it apply to the archival subjects you're writing about?
So the home seeker, I first read about this in the Iranian scholar Hamid Nafisi's book, An Accented Cinema, Exilic and Diasporic Filmmaking. And he published this over 20 years ago. And he originated this concept to describe how filmmakers used cinema, mainly feature films, to explore experiences of refugeehood and displacement in the so-called third world and global south since the 1950s and 60s. And my challenge, I think, was to see if we could migrate the spatial nuances of this concept of displacement and diaspora to filmmaking from the 1930s and 40s without diluting its original meaning. And so that's the challenge, is to, oftentimes these are kind of highly politicized concepts, and they still are. But for me, home seeking is a kind of universal concept, and it's portable, and it's a really productive way to track repeated movements of refugees, survivors, and displaced persons. And I looked at in the book as a way to kind of extract some of the spatial practices. I use this idea of home seeking to identify the kind of individual. So in chapter one, for example, we just have a Jewish refugees and displaced persons as a spatial figure. And then I talk about the mobility action being immigration. And then displaced persons in chapter two come on. And then chapter three, we have unhomed Jewish and non-Jewish children. So the idea of the home-seeking individual is, ageless, and also covers a great deal of kind of terrain and topography, but also it's a very, I've talked about as being, you know, heavily, obviously, geopolitical, territorial, personal, emotional, frustrating, and obstructed. And so really how we think about movement is, I really wanted to return it to places and unpack these kind of constructs that we have. And some people have said Simone isn't a homeseeker, just another synonym for a refugee and displaced person. And I've said, yes, however, I want to kind of think about talking about a kind of universal condition and saying that there's something more about more about the kind of administrative category or the stateless category of the refugee and displaced persons, and people occupy these positions repeatedly and in different times and places. And I think it's a bit more of a flexible category, so to speak, that it's for Jewish and non-Jewish kind of migrations.
So how does cinema come into this? How did using cinema, these films as a primary source, allow you as a historian to not just reconstruct the geographic movement, but kind of complicate in all of these ways the social and emotional and political, all of these categories that you were interested in? And how does that compare to, I think especially if we're thinking about geographic movement, how does cinema compare to other primary sources that are maybe more traditionally associated with that kind of work?
I mean, that's a great question. Hello. I'm not sure if I'll answer it fully, but I will try. So, and I think, you know, cinema to me is a cartography in itself. You know, it starts with a story. It gives you origins of character, of place, of movement, of, you know, the internal itinerary of the story and the kind of filmic images that really constitute either a short film or a feature film, they still have a mapping ambition and enterprise. And some of them, in the films that I looked at, they were all really about placemaking, place leaving, and about the Jewish refugee and displaced condition. So I looked at some, for example, so They Live Again, which is in chapter 3, and it explores the displacement of Jewish children in Tehran. So this film is what I'd say is geography light, meaning it gives us some sense of location through the narration, so these voiceovers, but it also has the integration of cinematic mapping and orientation through, you know, these cine maps and these devices. And this is a direct appeal to the viewer to empathize with the journeys of the children and the scales of displacement. We also have other kinds of mobility and movement that are more domestic and intimate, such as in chapter 6, where I look at kind of so-called home movies within DP camps. And here these self-screenings allow us to think about scale and intimacy and the level of the filmmaker, but how they also construct their own spatial zones. So the films themselves, we can read them as narrative maps, but we can kind of look at films as ways to map environments and places and engagements. And I think tools of geospatial analysis, which I looked at in the book and I do later on in chapter 7 and 8, help us tag images to locations. And I think as well an important companion to film is the photographic archive. And I've tried to create what I call kind of photo cartographies of the movement of Jewish displaced persons on the Rekha from Europe to Palestine, to kind of talk about, you know, how does mapping of these images give us a new version, a kind of animated, activated version of landscapes and historical movement. So it's kind of trying to rethink our reliance on kind of the singular media of an archive to tell the story, but to bring them together and have a broader conversation.
Very quickly, can you discuss the cinemaps? I was not familiar with them as a category until I read the book. Yeah.
Yeah. So a cinemap, for example, if you are watching even a commercial, if you're seeing an ad and then there will be like a pop-up of a map and it gives you these animations of direction and orientation, that is a kind of cinemap. And in most of the kind of fundraiser films that I look at, or in chapters 3 and 4, they're kind of educating the viewer. So it's introducing a geographic literacy because, you know, some people are kind of, you know, need a bit more guidance in knowing where places are. And this was particularly apparent in these films from this time period because they were almost like an educational intervention to say the world is big, people are dispersed in many locations, but you need to understand that this is where they're going from and coming to. But also these cinemaps were kind of politically problematic because they're also kind of showing people, you know, oh, they might be coming closer to you. This is what you need to do to intervene to prevent this in a way. So it's as much educational as kind of a caution. And this, the cinemaps still occur, but more so in the cartographic narratives of, say, ArcGIS and story maps today when mapping migration. I look at a little bit of that in the later chapters of the book and in the conclusion where we talk about mapping practices in cinema and these kind of distortions and disruptions, I guess, of how people understand place and possible threats to their stability.
I want to talk a little more about the fundraising films. There are a lot of genres that you address, and I personally saw them as a sort of contrast to another really interesting, well, the fundraising films are kind of throughout the book. And there you have this chapter on home movies. And I maybe overly simplistically saw them in sort of opposite ends of a spectrum, specifically in terms of the ways that these DPs were able to construct their own images. So would you be able to talk about that a little bit?
I can. I mean, and very kind of just to continue what you said, I agree. And, you know, the demarcation is right in a way. So you can imagine if we do a basic analogy, you know, someone being in front of the camera and then someone being behind and in front of the camera. So the fundraiser films were designed to, you know, raise monies among American, mainly Jewish audiences to support fundraising efforts and the JDC, the United Jewish Appeal, and other organizations in the United States, Zionist organizations in Palestine, and many others to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, these appeals to fundraise for, you know, education, supplies, basic relief provision, staffing, personnel. So the fundraisers were an interesting genre, and there's been some writing about them. These are short films, and to me they're an early kind of Holocaust cinema as such because they use the images of liberation and also wartime, mainly Nazi images from wartime, then liberator images from the early post-war period, and they kind of edit a kind of a version of survival, of persecution and survival that is what I think what you'd probably expect to see. Right, this persecution, survival, this is, they're tortured, people are homeless, people have need clothes, but they use a lot of the kind of tropes we associate with the Holocaust today, of barbed wire, of tattoos, of these kind of emaciated bodies. It is kind of unsettling, but these fundraising films were also kind of ubiquitous as well in kind of circulation in cinemas, for example. So the projections of the home movies, for example, is much more individual. So fundraisers, we can say institutional, and the home movies are individual. And they provide a kind of rejection of that image, of the institutional image. So they, to me, they represent a kind of visual liberation of these Holocaust era images, and these Holocaust era images that appear in fundraiser films tend to freeze the survivors into a permanent state of dependency on relief organizations. Whereas the home movies, although they're silent and the institutional fundraisers are vocalized, they tend to really force you to identify with the survivors and the living. And they occupy a homing instinct and intention and they permit the survivors an agency to assert and create their own images of self and family. And what's interesting, in fact, is that the people who made these home movies don't really leave a lot of materials about the making of the home movies. They leave a lot of other materials. So therefore, how do we read the intention of what they're showing? So therefore, we look at the images repeatedly, and we must associate them with the other archives through kind of distant reading to infer what their argument is. So Jack Sutton was one such person, and he was a camp photographer, for example, and he made a lot of films. He was a portrait photographer. He was very proud of the family that he, you know, he made during his time in Munich, and the images that he left, both the photography and the film, they do show this visual resistance to genocide, but they also embrace a future. And showed some of these images show him as walking on for the camera, you know, repeatedly. The daughter Cecilia is being paraded, as little kids are supposed to be doing in films. And then they want to express this freedom of movement and ability to record it. So we can see in these films and photography, documentation was his mission and passion. And so these home movies are much more individual, eclectic, idiosyncratic, and the fundraisers are a bit more institutional, public, and purposeful. And that I think there's a they are quite distinct, and you're right to really identify them. But my goal with juxtaposing them was to actually say there is no singular cinema of the displaced. There's many kinds of cinemas. Maybe I should have called the book Cinemas of the Displaced, but it's too late now.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Were the fundraising films called incentive films originally? I thought that was a really interesting phrase. I'd never come across that.
Yeah, so incentive films, and they weren't, you know, they weren't alone with these films. There were many others, you know, wartime, post-war education films. So the incentive was too, not just a kind of financial incentive, but there's an ideological incentive too, isn't there, to identify, to support their tools of mobilization and kind of education and alignment with a particular vision that's being spouted. So if you are kind of an unthinking kind of, or not too, you know, on it, you would say, yes, you know, this is, I do agree. And these films were very effective in fundraising, and that was the intention, but they haven't really been subjected to much of a critical analysis.
No, and there's so many. One of the questions I have, You address this, the availability of sources when it comes to the home movies as compared to a lot of the other subgenres of Holocaust cinemas that you are looking at. Did you feel limited at all in your analysis, just given the somewhat reduced access, just because of the way that suspect fewer were produced, and certainly fewer were archived and available digitally and all of these things. Was that an issue for you?
Well, you know, I'd been to the USHMM back in 2012, and I identified, you know, the range of movies, you know, fragments, newsreels that were available from these individual filmmakers. And in fact, the USHMM has a great range, you know, of these, but most of them are not readily digitized. So you have to write to them and ask them for access, whereas the Steven Spielberg Film and Video Archive at the USHMM, and also in at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, many of them have been kind of digitized. So I think the accessibility is a big influence on the kind of knowledge about them. But also, I think in a broader sense, I think there's a difficult place for these home movies because they don't fit the canon of what the kind of public sees as the Holocaust. You know, they show survival, and I think survival struggles to be integrated as a kind of visual knowledge of the Holocaust, and hence the kind of argument I talk about is the, you know, the persistent focus on the 1930s interwar period of films and Eastern Europe, as it should be, but where do these films fit in to these kind of visual image making, this visual culture and memory? And my goal was to really try to push that argument forward some more.
I wrote that down, what you just said, survival struggles to be integrated as a visual knowledge. And one of the things that really struck me in the, and I think this is a natural byproduct, right, of this sort of self-determination, that these are, in the home movies, these are these artifacts that are being created by and for the DPs themselves. One of the things that struck me that you do make explicit is the way that a lot of these complicate. If you think of what probably the average person on the street thinks of as the Holocaust experience, it's you're in a ghetto and then you're put on a train and you go to a camp and then you're either liberated or not, not to be too glib about it. But a lot of these home movies depict people who have had experiences, none of the above, right? Like that we're on these migratory patterns that are not exceptionally well known, that we're not in camps at all. You know, there's all of these range, there's an enormous range of experiences that are the Holocaust, that are not just, it's the same question, right? They're not part of the cinema, they're not part of the culture, and they're not that well known. It's the arrow is going both directions. But that kind of, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think the challenge, I think, is to bring in these new places and roots of the Holocaust into this understanding. Whereas I think we have the kind of public cinema has a very camp, ghetto focused knowledge, and mainly drawn from kind of feature films and liberation footage from the May, June 1945. This is the issue, and some of the liberations from Auschwitz and Majdanek. So we're talking about a kind of narrow geography of visual kind of information, so to speak. Yeah. And so that is addresses your kind of questions.
That gets at another phrase that struck me from the book, which is this idea of the archive of motion. What does this archive of visual and in library world, what we call time-based media, recordings of either sound or film, what does this archive reveal that an archive of, say, documents, static things cannot?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure if my answer will satisfy, but for me, it's the archive of motion. You know, as a historian, I've always been drawn to images and image making. And I thought when writing this book, I didn't really, how could I write about film without showing it? I don't really warm to film books where they assume you know the film, they assume you know the clip you're talking about. But here I wanted to actually, it's about an integrated experience of the reader come viewer. So the archive of motion is to really think about, you know, the moving image archive, but also to give it an orientation and also a pace, right? So the unstable and on the move with a wavering pace, much like in the way that the refugees and displaced persons experienced, you know, this historical moment was a kind of repeated displacement of months and years. But how do we actually express that in a kind of written form? Well, we don't really do that well. But whether or not film is another kind of way of, you know, writing, and this was talked about in chapter 9, where I talk about film and it's as a kind of form of writing with a camera. And therefore, the archive of motion for me is I've talked about as being a refusal or rejection of stability. And it's a really mechanized way of seeing, but I don't think documents can't be that either. It's really about a transformation of the document into a kind of a moving, you know, a form and what you do with this. So subjecting them to a kind of transformation, the idea of activating the archives, which means putting archives into their locational spaces. And this can be done with static analog documents, tagging them to locations. So for me, it's actually a mode of interaction. So taking either film or the document and elevating it and giving it another kind of life story an interactive kind of possibility. Same as when I think about photographic contact sheets, you know, we just see often photos, but when you see the whole contact sheets, you know, you have a big story here. And for me, this is an archive of motion too. But whether or not the mechanics of, you know, as Benjamin talked about, the work of art, the mechanic, age of mechanical reproduction. So we talk about the document here, you know, what is the status of the document and the age of digital production or reproduction or transformation? Are we looking at kind of similar transformation possibilities, not just the document, but elevating them into other kind of ways of reading or knowledge construction?
For any listeners, this is not the first time I'm going to have to link Walter Benjamin's The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanic Reproduction in the liner notes. It will be linked if you're interested. I'll link the other episode where that also comes up. I'm sure it won't be the last time. It's interesting. I think anyone who works with an archive is doing exactly what you just described. I think this reinterpretation is a form of motion, regardless of how legible it is. But I think the end product of this book is a really effective example of what can come of the scholar, the researcher, whoever, being really deliberate about telling us what they're doing with the documents, right? I think everybody, I don't think this is news to any historian. I think everybody thinks about it. But I think there is still some sort of resistance to talking about the process, this kind of like metacognition that's happening. But I, as a reader, I find it really interesting, not just because I'm an archivist. Anyway, I'm gonna take a bit of a turn, because there's a really interesting chapter that I want to make sure that we talk about. You mentioned chapter 3, this chapter on children, and how they're understood in Holocaust cinema. And one thing I want to flag really quickly, that really stuck out to me, is this idea of these children who have lost someone has lost custody of them, their parents, their country, perhaps the international community, insofar as everyone is responsible for children. This idea of uncontrolled mobility in these children. I don't want to get ahead of your answer. I will let you answer. But I think, given the broader context of the project, and then there's this really just core example of, we often think of mobility as a sort of freedom. And I think this chapter really drives home the ways that it is not, it can be a burden, it can be unmanageable. Anyway, I'm going to let you answer. I'm going to stop talking.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. Hello. So this was a really interesting kind of chapter to write, because it's so rich, and children have occupied, you know, a focal point for many scholars of the Holocaust, and talking about children's representation in film, in hiding, and orphanages, and, you know, don't get me started on Life is Beautiful, so I won't. However, but I was going to say that children, I looked at, you know, mainly some kind of fundraiser films in Seeds of Destiny, which was a kind of behemoth for its time. And I looked at, you know, this was an interesting case. You know, David Miller was a kind of filmmaker for the US Army, and I'd actually looked at the archives in Beverly Hills, and I was able to reconstruct his journey across Europe and Africa based on their expense accounts, where they went. And there's a huge archive there, kind of waiting to be really looked at in detail. But really, as much as this film is about the children, it's also about the filmmakers and their commitment to understanding the kind of epic displacement, and really children, to kind of find children, rehome them, get them off the streets, this was the kind of challenge of orphaned and unaccompanied children. So I talked about how children, at the time in fiction and nonfiction film, were the most kind of reliable and, of course, tragic narrators of the Holocaust's extremity and its displacement. And when I mean displacement from families, nations, societies, kind of morals that they should be kind of taught with and retain. And they're the most effective communicators to audiences about the need to build moral and financial partnerships for peace building and reconstruction. And this was particularly in fundraiser films. The films that I looked at were a mix of kind of Zionist films, US Army films, for example, and they projected children of symbols of national and familial decline and the objects of custody. So where and to whom do these orphaned or unclaimed children belong? Was it to the Zionist organizations who are wanting to say, let's bring the children to Palestine, or the orphanages in Europe, or the foster families that were lining up to take them because they didn't have children or wanted more for whatever reason? So it's not only a post-war question, it was anticipated during the 1930s era of migration and persecution. So here, even in this period, we see representations of helplessness, dependency, and the necessity of relocation to boarding schools, convents, hiding, or resettlement schemes like the Kinder Transport. And you know, there's a new film called One Life with Anthony Hopkins coming out about Nicholas Winton. So it's this kind of persistence of this rescue narrative. Children have constructed as symbols of decline and hope. And Holocaust cinema is no different in projecting these kind of binaries. But these films also did something and raised the alarm about the future of children outdoors in untamed and wild totalitarian landscapes. As much as war put children outside into the rubble and the roads into danger, post-war cinema wanted to put them back inside the home, right, and limit their mobility. And here there are larger associations about the politics and places of play and regulated movement. So there's something about outdoor living. This is paramount, I think, not just in this chapter, but in other chapters too, as to where do people live while they're displaced? You know, where do these children, where do they find a home? Is it in the rubble, in old buildings, etc.? And it was also apparent in post-war European cinema. So films like Somewhere in Europe, The Search, this is a real preoccupation with kind of Hungarian and French cinema, in particular German, the neorealist cinema, the Italian neorealist cinema. So it's about, you know, children carried the burden, as you said, of wartime events and storytelling. And you know that they would really appeal to this international morality and mindset about rescue and finding them a decent home and thereby reversing the kind of future totalitarian, you know, seed that had been planted. It was all about reversing that. That's particularly apparent in Seeds of Destiny.
I will admit my bias here, which is that I've written about this. I should probably write about it more. But children as archival subjects, for very good reasons. There are very, very limited collections that are directly from children in real time. Right? So even if we look at the Holocaust literature, there's plenty on the experiences of children. A lot of it is sort of constructed from all sorts of administrative records. A lot of it is from adults recollecting childhood experiences. I got interested in this because I work at YIVO, as you know, and perhaps anyone listening knows, but if you haven't read my little bio, that's where I work. We have a collection I'll link it, of their transcripts of sort of what we would now call oral histories and children, paint drawings collected from children in these post-war orphanages. And I was working with it and I was like, I've never seen anything. I've seen very little directly from young children. There's plenty from adolescents, but right. So I got interested in this idea of children as subjects, and there's really this is something I think the archival field is becoming more interested in, but you know, children, depending on where you are, regardless of where you are, the scale differs, but they're an enormous portion of any population, really, and they have distinct experiences from adults. And in collections, you know, archivists, whoever, are not going directly to them for good kind of moral reasons. But it means there's this major gap. And I think Seeds of Destiny. I think it's this really interesting example that goes into what we were talking about earlier with the fundraising films, of this sort of lack of self-determination in how you're represented. And I think children have that across the board in a lot of areas of scholarship. And I think a lot of what you write about here really gets at that. That's my soapbox. That's my archivist soapbox about children in the archival record.
And Halal, do you mind me asking you a question? Okay, and those records that you looked at, I mean, how do you enter that debate about self-representation then of children and agency?
So I, in the process of writing the one piece that I wrote on this, and again, I know that I'm talking about it, I think I should pick it up again, but this was during COVID, and a lot of libraries and archives were doing these, you know, submit your COVID-19 experiences to our collections. And I got in touch with a number of archivists and librarians who were actively soliciting from children. And I talked, you know, they weren't like going out of their way, but they were open to children. I talked to one organization that was actively soliciting from teenagers. And I kind of talked to them about how they were thinking about that and what was coming up. And where I landed is, it's something either, you know, if a guardian, in terms of consent, if a guardian is comfortable with children, their charges sharing, I think that's fine. I think being in an archive, sharing your experiences is for a lot of people kind of empowering, even for children. And then in terms of how we kind of understand children as reliable historical sources, I think anyone who's responsibly doing history research approaches any source with the understanding that these are mediated reports, you have to understand things in their context, et cetera, et cetera. I think perhaps you think about it differently for children, but I think a lot of the arguments against collecting from children kind of imply that otherwise you're not thinking about it at all, which I don't think is true. I think you just know this is from a young child and you kind of analyze it appropriately. But that's true for anything from anyone, right?
I think you're right. And the kind of the perspective is important. And I kind of asked you that question because one of my other projects that I kind of work on, as most people do on the side, is on, you know, mapping and survivors' maps and how they saw their worldview. And I went to the Wiener Holocaust Library in London, you know, to discuss what sources they had. And they said, Simone, have you seen this project? And it was by an organization, NGO, called Waging Peace. And they were drawn by child survivors of the genocide in Darfur. So they have 500 of these images, and exactly like you were talking about. And this campaigns, this organization against genocide and abuses. And then what was interesting, in November 2007, the drawings were accepted by the International Criminal Court as contextual evidence of the crimes committed in Darfur. So this is a kind of transformation, again, isn't it, of these drawings as this kind of evidentiary kind of narrative and text. So the fact is, I think we kind of tend to, you know, put children in boxes and here are the kind of drawings and this is perspective, but these actually, you know, they are testimony and they can be used, you know, in different ways and kind of, you know, as evidence for support of criminal, you know, prosecution case here.
Right. I think I have many children in my life. I respect and admire them. You know, they're people. They have experiences, and the ways that they choose to share them are valid. And underlying this lack of collection is, I think, the implication that they are not valid in some way. But as you say, they I mean, I don't think that there's any more kind of legitimizing a stamp than being used as evidence in international criminal court. All right, we'll get back to your work now. That kind of leads me to our classic closing question. We do have more to talk about, as ever. So, listeners, you should read the book, since there's plenty more, but we're running out of time. So I will ask, what are you working on now?
So at the moment, I'm developing aspects of this project, and really the home movies and self-projection, sorry, as forms of testimony and creative kind of visual and political practice about, movement and obstruction in times of conflict and post-conflict. And I'd like to investigate these practices a bit more in local and transnational kind of terms, especially in relation to cine clubs. This is a global practice of people and home movies and the family and regeneration, but also kind of cultivating social and community spaces through home movies. The Jewish DPs were active and vigilant image makers, and they're really part of a global cinematic movement, whether they knew it or not. And it seemed to kind of embolden them even more to put this record of archive, the record of their kind of a displacement. Down, and it really, to me, it gives them some kind of hope as well, is that they're creating this, but will they return to it? And really, the story is the fate of these movies. Do they go with the survivors, which they do most of the time, to a new country? Do they get rewatched? When do they get donated to the museums? What's the kind of pathway from their kind of status as home movie to kind of archival source? This is the kind of big question, I think, is that we haven't really grappled with too much. This is something I
Yeah,
want to address.
I agree. Well, I will keep an eye out, and you'll probably get an email from me to come back whenever that's published. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Hello. Thank you so much.